Welcome to
BirdWorld.com. A podcast for those involved in designing, developing, and running websites. This is what everybody waits for.
It's 9 a.m. on the 9th of October, and you're listening to the 97th episode of BoagWorld.com, a podcast for those involved in designing, developing, and running websites on a daily basis. Why on earth are we recording this at 9 a.m?
It won't be 9 a.m. for anyone listening to this, Paul. We do realise that.
Yes, I know.
It won't be 9 a.m. on the 9th of October for anyone.
But I wanted people to know that we're stupid enough to record this podcast first thing in the morning. Although I feel surprisingly awake today.
Well, chipper
yeah. Even. Yeah.
I was having a blog type conversation with one of our listeners. It's a long story which I won't go into, but basically he said, tell Paul to stop whinging about his colds.
Oh, well, hey, ask to him.
Stop whining.
Yeah, I'm a whiner. I like being a whiner. Yeah, so here we are. 100th episode coming up, 97 under our belt. So I've just got back from Futures Web Apps last week. It was very interesting. I'll tell you more about it in a minute because I'm going to do that as a news story. Gossip from Futures Web Apps. So that's cool. Have you been working hard while I've been swanning around and going to parties and things?
As ever, yes. We're financing your life of luxury, Paul.
I know. It's cool. One day you're going to realise that this is a really bad idea and that I ought to actually do something constructive with my time. But until that, I'll enjoy myself.
It's more fun taking the piss out of you saying that you've forgotten how to do design.
I have forgotten how to do design. But who cares? Actually, it was quite embarrassing. There was a conversation I had with somebody that listens to the show and is also quite well known, but I won't give away his name, who turned around to me and said, so what exactly is it that you do? Because I'm not entirely sure. Neither was I, really. It was quite embarrassing. So, yes. Jack of all trades and master of bugger all. That's me.
Cool,
but there we go.
So what is it exactly that you do? Why don't you tell the listeners?
So what's on this week's show then, Marcus? What are you changing the subject? So tell us what you're doing on this week's show, will you, Marcus, please?
So you used to do design.
Yes, all right. Okay, here we go. I'm going to make something up that sounds impressive. I'm a user experience consultant. That sounds good. What are you laughing at? That's a good title.
Do you say things like, we're going to hit the ground running, Paul?
Oh, piss off. Anyway, what are you doing on today's show?
I'm talking a bit of a subject close to our hearts, budgets, and basically why sometimes clients won't release them.
Of course you are. Because I've posted this live on the website already.
All right.
Because I thought I'd do it as a separate blog post. There's been some good comments. You ought to read them. It did sound like the most bitter and twisted blog post that's ever gone on the site. I've written all the others, that's saying something.
I didn't mean to sound that. That's why I sent this. I sent this to you, Paul, saying, is this too cynical? And he said, no, do it. Great.
But it is.
I don't really mean it cynically. It's just life. That's the way it is.
And but talking about bitter and twisted, my segment isn't much better because I'm tackling how to overcome design by committee, which is a particular bugbear of mine. So between the two of us, this could be interesting.
Yes, the proper moaning show. Moan.
The Bitter and Twisted Show. So we've also got Dan Cederholm on, and he brings a bit of sanity to the proceedings. And he's going to talk about pixels, M's, and percentages. In other words, fixed, fluid, or elastic websites, and how you make the decision about which way to go. But yeah, before we get onto that, this again, it's going to be a long introduction. Will you talk quickly about the 100th episode that's coming up?
Okay.
So hang on a minute. First of all, we need to know, I need to give them the URL that, yes. Yeah, so you can sign up to go to the 100th episode at upcoming.yahoo.com/event/224744. But the real reason I'm bringing it up is I've kind of made a decision about how the show is going to work. So the plan is as follows. We're going to go for a normal format show of news, Marcus's bits, Paul's bit, and Ask an Expert. But in the news segment, we're going to do the top four news stories that have most affected web design since the show was launched in August 2005. So if you've got ideas of you think are really big things that have happened in web design since August 2005, send them in to me at paul@boagworld.com. Because otherwise I'll have to come up with them myself, and that'll suck, because that'll be work on my part. Marcus, what are you doing? Can you remember what your segment was going to be on?
Amazingly, I can at this time of the morning. What I want to do is basically kind of, it's just a kind of storytelling session. I want you all to send me stories of your most unreasonable clients, and and discuss them. Cool. I might think of one or two. Obviously, if you can name them, even more fun, but we can just talk about them. We can give them false names and everything. It'd be good fun.
Yeah. You can send those to marcus@boagworld.com. And for those that of you that get confused, Marcus is spelled M-A-R-C-U-S, because I've heard some bizarre spellings of your name. What am I going to be doing? I'm going to be doing the worst web design mistakes of all time. So what's the worst possible thing you could do to your website in order to screw it up badly? So you can send those to me at paul@boagworld.com. And then finally, we're going to do an Ask the Expert section where anybody can ask us questions, and we will be the experts. You can ask us any questions about web design or anything else you fancy, really. Marcus wants questions about music or something. I don't know.
That'd be good.
And I want questions about, I have no expertise whatsoever. So there you go. So you can either turn up on the night and obviously contribute live on the show, or alternatively you can email us or even send an MP3 and we're going to include your contributions in the show. Also, don't forget, you can just drop us an email with the subject 100 in the title, and just give us your name and where you are, and we're going to do a little blog roll. Although I have to say, we're getting so many of those that I don't think we'll be able to include them all actually in the show, but we're going to include them all in the show notes. So at least you'll get mentioned there. We really have listeners from all over the world. I was talking to a guy yesterday, right, who grew up in Kenya and currently lives in Japan, which I thought was a bizarre mix. So, yeah, all around the world. We are internationally famous.
I was going to say, we can read them all out. I'll just speed it up. So we
sound That's a good idea. I like that. So we sound like chipmunks. That's so cool. Or Smurfs. Oh, yeah. Smurfs. Anyway, let's move on to the news. So, I've been at... Did I mention, Marcus, that I've been swanning around at a conference this last week? Did I mention that?
I think you did, Paul, yes.
That's good.
Nobody even knows what you do these days. You could be doing anything all day, Paul. You really could be getting away with
it. I do. I just swan around at conferences, having adoring fans throwing themselves at my feet.
The rest of us just do lots of hard work, you know, it gets harder every week.
So it was a superb conference, I have to say, Marcus. Really enjoyable. Great lineup of speakers. Excellent subject matter. Totally inspiring. Really good supporting expo. You know, that you could walk around and see all these little Web 2.0 companies that were going to go out of business at any minute. It was just wonderful. However, I'm not bringing it up simply to gloat. although that is a major part of it. What was quite interesting, I got to speak to some great people and learn a few things that I thought was worth passing on. I think probably the thing that was very important to mention is that it became very apparent through conversations I had and various other things that that podcasting is getting pretty serious now as a marketing medium. And it really is becoming much more mainstream. I had a really long chat with David Prager, who works at Revision 3, the company that produces Dignation. It sounds like things are really taking off for them. They've got some really big name advertisers on board, and not all their shows are as big as Dignation. I mean, Dignation is very good, but there were definitely, the advertisers are definitely beginning to invest in podcasts, and obviously that's very interesting. However, it wasn't just the advertising model that they were pushing there. There was, or that you could kind of see going on there. There was also the approach that we take, whereby we basically the podcast kind of sells our services, and that was interesting as well. I got talking to a guy called Gary who does a podcast or videocast called Wine Library TV. That if you haven't checked out, it's definitely worth checking out. So he basically runs this huge, what is called a wine library, which is a massive store that's three-story store that sells loads of wine. They sell loads of stuff on the internet. And he does this video podcast where he reviews wine every week, which obviously then you can go and buy and stuff. And it's pretty hugely popular, partly because Gary is an amazingly charismatic guy. It's a superb show. It's definitely worth checking out. So it's nice to talk to some of these people about podcasting and, seeing where it's going and how people are monetizing it and all of that kind of stuff. And how, even big names are really considering it a potential advertising stream. So that was quite interesting. But I guess the real power of podcasting came across that there was a live taping of Dignation there. And Marcus, it was kind of depressing, to be honest, because although we like to think that we're famous and really important, we're really not. So
no, Paul, you're not.
Oh, you are. Oh, you were. Sorry, you were. I think that's even worse, isn't it? To be famous. Yeah. Once
well, no, you know, never to have loved and all that stuff.
Yeah. So at the moment, right, on our upcoming page for our live BOAG World recording for our 100th episode, we've got 70 people attending. Now, I'm sure that number will go up a little, but I considered that exciting. I thought that was a good number. It'll create a good evening. We can have a bit of a laugh and it'll be great. The Dignation live recording, on the other hand, had 1,200 people turn up, and it was more like a rock concert than a geek conference. It was absolutely incredible. So, Kevin
Rose,
might
have 900 extra people that can't be bothered to sign up or something.
Yeah, we might do, or we might not. So anyway. So that was quite interesting, just kind of seeing where podcasting's at the moment. It was absolutely incredible sitting in watching that happen. But I also got to speak to some great speakers as well and have a chat with them about what they were doing, and that was cool. And also got to hear a stellar performance by Daniel Birker, who we had on the show a little while back. And it was the first time ever that he presented at a conference, and he was absolutely incredible. But I think the other thing that I really wanted to share about the conference is that there were a couple of rumors about Google knocking around that I just wanted to mention. The first was the fabled G phone that everybody's been talking about. There's obviously definitely something coming out of Google, but it looks like it's going to be an operating system rather than a specific hardware device. So they're going to kind of be going up against Microsoft's Windows Mobile rather than going up against something like Apple's iPhone, which I thought was quite interesting. And if it's true, it's going to produce yet another platform for creating cool, web-based mobile applications. So the mobile sector is very interesting at the moment.
Something else to test. Yeah,
more things to test. Yeah, fair comment. But finally, I did want to also mention the imminent announcement of Google in relationship to its APIs. It's looking like Google is going to open up many of its online offerings, things like Gmail or Docs, to allow third parties to build web applications based on them. And I think that sounds like a very exciting opportunity for developers and things like that. Mm. So there you go, bit of gossip from Future Web App. How much of that is actually of any value to anybody? I very much doubt, but it gave me a chance to name drop and to say the cool stuff I've been doing. Sorry about that. Okay, next news story up is yet another, I'm sorry about this, I can't help it, it's an addiction, I need to get over it. It's yet another list from Smashing Magazine. This really is beginning to get boring. They seem to have a never-ending list of lists, if that is such a thing. Perhaps you ought to do the top list of lists, the best lists, the top 10 lists, yeah. This one attempts to bring together some general stats of on web users from various sources. And, you know, okay, we all know that in reality you should look at your own stats when you're trying to kind of get an idea of your users and things like that. But occasionally there are times when you want to get a more general picture of you know, what web users are doing. So they post, I think it's 8 facts that you should know about the average web user. So these include, but are not limited to, there was more than this. The most popular browser, oh, I bet you can't guess what that is. The most common screen resolution, the most popular operating system, the most popular browser family, in other words, group of browsers worldwide, again, you'll never guess what that is. The most popular browser in Europe, the most common browser size, all kinds of different bits and pieces. So that's definitely worth checking out if you want to kind of get a broader overview and have something to compare your own user stats to.
That's useful for me, actually. People are always asking me that.
Yeah, I mean, I get that as well with emails, you know, from people going, oh, do you have anything on it? And so that's the article that you want to check out for that one. Be good.
I usually just make it up and then admit that I'm making it up a minute later.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, like pretty much everything in this show, really.
Yeah.
Okay, next up is, well, I'm very conscious that the future of web apps thing was a bit kind of pie in the sky and is only going to affect a small percentage of our audience. And I know that some of the people that listen to this show are not actually web designers. Some of you are developers or clients or even students learning web design or whatever. Some of you are basically just starting out in web design. So if you fall into this category and want to get a better understanding of the kind of key web design tools are out there, then this next suggestion, this next news story is for you, which is an article on SitePoint, and it's a detailed tutorial which introduces you to Photoshop. So Marcus, you ought to read this because it really goes from kind of the basics of the user interface of how it's kind of, you know, how the panes are organized.
I'm an expert Photoshop user.
You're not.
No, I'm not.
You're not starting from scratch.
I enjoyed saying it.
Yes, even though it's not true. You know, you would know the basic stuff, but this goes from the real basic stuff all the way through to things like alpha channels and things like that. As you can imagine, it's a pretty long read, but I think it's one of the best introductions I've been able to find on what is the kind of de facto standard in web design kind of graphics editor thingy majiggies. Yeah. So there you go.
You were doing so well there.
Yeah,
and
I lost it at the end.
It at the end.
Yeah. Okay, so let's get news wrapped up so we can move on to something and I can wake up a bit. Talking of waking, that was a good segue there, into a new post put up by the 37 Signals guy called Waking the Sleepers. And now this post is primarily written about those running web applications, but actually the principles apply to a much broader audience. Now, sleepers are those users who kind of sign up for a service but never actually use it or they stop using it. And that's a particularly big problem at the moment with Web 2.0 fatigue, where people sign up for all these different Web 2.0 apps, have a quick play, and then give up on them. Now, this kind of is clearly applicable to those kind of web applications, but I also think it's applicable to, I don't know, e-commerce sites where you've had people purchase in the past, but they you know, haven't purchased for a long time, or if you're offering a newsletter or other registered features. So it asks how to kind of reinvigorate these users and encourage them to become active again. And they use an email sent around by StumbleUpon, which is a service that you might have heard of before, which is an example of how to kind of kickstart people and breathe some life back into those kinds of users. So if you're struggling with an apathetic user base, then it's worth taking a look at this article. Okay, so I think that about wraps up the new segment for today. And let's move on to Marcus's Bitter and Twisted segment of the show.
Okay, this isn't really bitter and twisted. It's just, as I said, it's part of life, my life, part of the life of anyone who's done a pitch or responded to a proposal. Here's the situation. I receive an invitation to tender in my inbox from a potentially good client. It's a good brief, it's well written, and for the most part, the requirements are clear. First thing I do is check the timescales, because obviously if the timescales are unreachable, then we just say no thanks. The second thing I look for is the budget. This is a guess, but I would say that 7 out of 10 invitations to tender don't include any budgetary guidance. So I phone up the people to try and discuss this with them. The private sector is usually, well, it's usually amused, actually, sort of, why on earth are you asking me? Or sometimes they're affronted that I'm asking. And I'm basically told that that's why we're asking you. You tell me, kind of thing. Really helpful. And the public sector just states that it isn't allowed to tell me, even though it is actually half the time, but they say they're not. I then spend a day or two of my time preparing our proposal, and this is often followed by us being shortlisted, so I drag Paul out of deepest, darkest Dorset, and we both travel to present our pitch, which is another 2 days of our time. A week or so later, the client calls to say that our proposal was probably the best, high quality, da-da-da-da-da, but basically we were too expensive. Anyone who's ever got involved in a pitch will now be nodding their heads, I've written here.
I'm nodding.
Yeah. And it still does happen, but pretty rarely. So I don't want to get too cynical here. This scenario happens less and less. I think that's, A, because I try to avoid it as much as I possibly can. And secondly, that I think clients are getting better and they understand the difficulty it can cause, so are less likely to keep the budget under wraps, but some do. And then I thought, well, why do we need to know the budget? That's what a lot of clients say. I mean, because they're, as a client, you're thinking, well, I don't want to let my budget go because, all the prices are going to come back 1% below whatever I tell them. But anyway, the first reason and most honest reason that I've kind of hinted at so far is that we don't want to do a lot of unpaid work when there's no chance that our price will be accepted. It's pointless. Who would? The analogy I've used here is that it's like having 10 grand to spend on a car and then going out to test drive an Aston Martin, which costs 100 grand. You're completely wasting the Aston Martin dealer's time. And by the way, I'm not suggesting that Headscape is like Aston Martin. Maybe I am. I don't know.
No, we're far more dull than that.
Yes, we're more of a kind of sort of
Vauxhall. Middle,
well, I was going to say middle of the range Audi, quite reliable.
Or a Volvo.
Yeah, a Volvo, perfect. Yes, we are the Volvo web designers.
How depressing is that?
I've got a Volvo. It's superb.
Yeah, but it's not exactly exciting, is it?
Oh, but I drive my wife's MG every now and then. There you go. I really am going off track.
Perhaps I ought to be the MG of web design and you can be the Volvo.
Yeah, okay. That sounds about right.
Although MG is a girl's car, I always think so.
Yeah, especially the one my wife's got. It's a proper girl's car. It's very
anyway,
nice.
That's the tangent. Sorry.
Yes. But about... We don't want to do a load of work for something we don't have any chance of winning. And that kind of goes both ways. Because you're wasting, the client's time is being wasted as well. I mean, it might just simply be that they're wasting their time reading through your proposal and then throwing it in the bin. But what if all of their bids are way too expensive? And that's quite possible, because quite often you get you'll get a brief through that asks for everything under the sun. And the budget is fairly small, but no one knows what it is. So all of the responses that go back will be far too expensive. And then the client's wasted loads of his own or her own time. So it kind of goes both ways, that one. The second reason why we need to know budgets relates to what we would like to include in a proposal over what we need to include. because there are some extras. A good example would be usability testing. We always highly recommend that a client pays for at least one round of usability testing because it'll definitely improve their site. No question about it. But not doing it doesn't mean that they'll end up with a turkey. It's just more likely that the usability issues will kind of crop up bit by bit once the site's live, which is not as good, but not the end of the world. So do I include usability testing or not? Another good example of this is additional design concepts. Some clients are really into design and they want to see, and they're quite happy to pay for two or three different design concepts, and we'll get two or three different designers here onto the job. But if I don't know what the budget is, then I'll probably just include one, cost for one concept. So I'm less likely to do that if I don't know what the budget is.
I think that is really worth stressing, because reading some of the comments that are on your post on this, Andy Yates, you might know Andy, don't you?
Yeah.
Says, I think clients are reluctant to give a figure because 9 out of 10 times when you quote a budget figure, you get a price from an agency that is within 2% of that. Funny that. And, you know, the reason that occurs is because of precisely what you've just described. You know, to say, let's go back to the car analogy, okay? Mm. You know, to say, I want a car, well, the type of car that you get depends on the budget you've got. You know, so if you've a limited budget, you end up with a Skoda. You know, if you've got a big budget, you end up with, you know, something higher end. And equally, even within, you know, even if you say you're specific and say, I want a BMW, well, you know, if you start in adding things like sat nav and, you know, all those optional extras of aircon and all those extra stuff, that'll all affect the price. And it's the same with web design. That the reason why you then, when you do give the budget, all of the things that come in live up to the budget is because we're adding more in, you know, that you could have things like usability testing and stuff like that.
Yeah, exactly that. I'll kind of summarize that a bit more at the end, but just my way of basically trying to stop this process happening, and the way that I usually tackle it. So how do I find out what a budget is basically to provide a ballpark total, and it's more than just we reckon it will cost between, I don't know, 10 and 30 grand or something like that, because that's no help to anyone. I'll put together an email response with a likely list of tasks for this type of project, or I might discuss it over the phone, but it's a bit more official if you're doing it via an email, and an associated price with those type of lists of tasks. This usually gets the discussion going, even with those public sector people who can't discuss it. They're not allowed to. The amount of times that I've been told we can't discuss budget, and then I go back with a ballpark and they say, well, that's okay, we've got a little bit more than that, or no, that's too expensive. I'm like, well, you just told me you couldn't discuss this. But anyway, so it can kind of get the conversation going. But expect a lot of people to dismiss you out of hand. That's good. That's what the whole process is about. Don't be tempted to just go for it because you quite fancy this particular client, because you'll regret it. If you're told this is way too expensive, walk away immediately. That's the whole point of this exercise. Mm. Others will say that the ballpark's okay. This isn't as good as getting into a proper discussion about what priorities they might have, but it does mean that you're not wasting your time and you do have a chance of winning the work. So go for it. The only real risk with this approach is if you misinterpret what the client wants and you produce an inaccurate ballpark, because the last thing you want to do is say it's going to cost 15 grand, and then when you get into the detail of it, it's going to cost 50 grand, because you're going to have a fairly unhappy client. Well, you won't win the work. But so you need to put a little bit of effort in. I suppose what I'm saying is put half an hour's worth of effort in thinking this is a kind of an X-type project or a Y-type project, and you know the kind of tasks that are associated with that type of project, and you can therefore put a ballpark figure next to it. Obviously, if it's something completely bespoke, then you know you've got to weigh it up and discuss it in-house. But it's a really good way I've found of finding out projects that are worth responding to. Mm. But there's another way, which I quite often use. It's a kind of less confrontational approach than going and saying, we reckon it's going to cost you this or that. And it basically involves modular pricing. We always break down our pricing into quite detailed tasks for all our proposals. But when I really don't have a clue about a client's budget, I'll often separate pricing into core items, i.e. things that we feel you're going to have to pay for, and optional items. I mean, it's fairly obvious, but it's proved to be a very effective method of presenting price. I tend to go down this road with prospective clients who have they've been told about us via someone else that's worked with us, by i.e. personal recommendation, because it's more likely that they already know the kind of rates that we charge, so there's no point in getting into that kind of slightly confrontational, this is what I think you should be spending conversation. And it seems to work really well. Mm. So that's me on budgets, I suppose. That wasn't too cynical, was it?
No, it wasn't cynical at all. It was quite a disappointment, really. I was hoping for, you know, real venom to come out, but I'll have to try my design by committee segment to be venomous then.
Bugwrite.com.
So, design by committee, eh? Ah, what a joy. Design by committee, yeah, let's face it, can be the nail in the coffin of many a good design concept. So the question is then, how do you minimise the damage done when a client decides to get approval for a design through a committee structure? Okay, the problem is that design by committee involves compromise. Everybody's got slightly different opinions about design, and so the design is tweaked in order to ensure that everybody's concerns are addressed. And this results, the result of this is inevitably that it offends nobody, but it fails to excite anybody. In short, it's basically unobtrusive design. And unlike unobtrusive JavaScript, unobtrusive design is ugh. Okay, now that's not entirely fair. Unobtrusive design does have its place. A mediocre design can still be very usable and can meet the needs of its target audience. However, it's never going to excite them or inspire them, and it will never create any sense of brand loyalty or generate a feeling of satisfaction in a site. So, presuming we don't want unobtrusive design, how do we deal with design by committee? Well, the best approach is to limit the number of people making design decisions. Ideally, this should just be the designer and the website manager. However, realistically, this isn't always the case. And in the real world, internal politics require that you've got to consult with everybody and everybody have their say. Now, but there is a difference, and I think this is an important distinction to make. There's a difference between consulting with people and design by committee. The key to successfully avoiding design by committee is getting all the parties to agree to a process before the design even begins, and that process is more consultative in nature than it is design by committee. In my experience, I use the kind of following approach, and it seems to work fairly successfully. First up...
Can I just butt in there, Paul?
Yeah.
I'd say that you used the bully boy approach. This is how it's going to be. I designed it. Like it.
That is not true. you haven't listened. I mean, I there would have been a stage when perhaps I'd use that, but now I go for the path of least resistance. And you should hear me on conversations these days. I take a different, a much more gentle approach than that, you cynical git. Okay, so anyway, this is the approach. I'm just winding you up.
You know, yeah, I am.
Stop talking. Don't want to listen to you anymore.
I'll put myself on. Okay.
Yes, that would be great. Thank you very much. I wish I could do that. Oh, that'd be so cool if that was a way of me turning you off. Oh, never mind. So, I mean, this is the approach that I use. I suppose I could just turn your volume down. That'd do it. I'll get there in a minute. Right, the approach that I use. So, the designer produces the initial design concepts. Okay, and then. Working with personas and business objectives, the designer and the website manager refine those concepts together, all right? So at the moment, there are only two people involved, the designer and your primary point of contact that I've called a website manager. Now, the website manager and, if possible, the designer should then meet individually with the stakeholders to talk through the design, all right? The website manager and the designer should then collate all the feedback that they've received and make any amendments they feel are necessary. Then, and I think this is an important step and something we've talked about before, the design should be presented to real users and their feedback is taken. All right, so we've talked about design testing before. The design is then revised into a final iteration, the one that you want to get signed off. And that final design is presented to all of the stakeholders as a group, but supported by the user testing that we've done, the design testing that we've done, and also selective quotes from the stakeholder interviews that we did. And that will make, I think, the whole process go a lot smoother. And I think the crucial step there is meeting with the stakeholders individually initially rather than the group. By meeting with them individually, you prevent what I call design on the fly. And this is when you get a group of people that kind of start changing a design in an attempt to reach a consensus. So they're all sitting in a room together and they're all disagreeing because design is very subjective and everybody has their individual opinion. But instead of, they know they have to come to a resolution on the design, so they start designing on the fly in the meeting in order to kind of reach a consensus, and that absolutely sucks. You know, without a doubt, that's design by committee and it's completely worse. Worst, even. By meeting with people on a one-to-one basis, you can simply listen to their opinion and then collate all the suggestions later. So no design decisions are being made in the room. So it puts you much more in control of the whole process. Now, it's important, or it's also important that these meetings not be a simply a matter of showing them the design and asking what they think. It's important that when you show a design to kind of internal stakeholders, you provide them with background information that enables them to make a kind of, provide educated feedback. So you need to talk in particularly about any user personas you've created or objectives that exist for the project or anything like that, so that they're informed in making their design decisions, so to speak. And now, when you do show them the design, whatever you do, don't ask them their opinion. Don't say to them, what do you think of the design, all right? Because that's when you get into the realms of personal opinion. Rather, ask them how they believe the target audience is going to react to the design, or whether the design meets the business objectives. So try and remove personal opinion from it. The aim is to encourage them to think beyond their personal preferences and to focus on the business and user requirements instead. I think by adopting this process, by the time you actually get to that design sign-off phase, you've already got everybody on board, and so it's going to be a lot easier. They've contributed to the process, they've been given all the background information, they've seen the design testing and have been educated to think from the user's perspective. Once you've done all of that, you've basically done everything that's possible in order to minimize the effect of design by committee. So hopefully that helps. It does seem to work if in a lot of cases. I'm not going to claim that it solves all problems, but it certainly seems to smooth the way a little bit. So there we go. That's my segment for the day. Birdworld.com. So one of the most common questions that I seem to get time and time again, as far as CSS is concerned, revolves around working with M's and pixels and percentages and what to use when and how to work out what you should be using and all of that kind of thing. So I thought, let's get an expert in. And so I have Dan Cederholm joining me. Hello, Dan.
Hello, Paul.
Don't snigger. Hello. You are the expert for today.
I'll try to be. I'll put on my expert hat.
Just go with the flow. It's fine.
I will.
Okay. So, Dan, yeah, like I said, this is a common question that we get asked. And I'm just interested in your opinion about, you know, when's the right time to use, you know, what combination? Should we be mainly using M? Should we mainly be using percentages? Should we be going pixels? What's your take on the discussion?
Well, I think it, in a very politician-esque way, I'd say it depends. and this call is over. I could just hang up now.
Okay. Depends.
No, I'm just kidding.
On what, then?
It depends. Yeah, so it depends. Now, are you referring to strictly just font sizing or just units in general for boxes and things?
I mean, there's lots of different things, isn't there? There's kind of, do we make, you know, when we design a whole website, you know, should the website be fixed width? Should it be hybrid? Should it be fluid? Should it be built so it's elastic? Let's start with that as a discussion.
Okay. Yeah. So width in general. Well, I think, you know, like I said, it does depend. It's a tough decision to make, depending on the site and depending on what's in the site and the design and that kind of thing. It can be tricky. You know, I love M-based design, and that's what I use currently on Simple Bits and a few other sites that I've done recently. But I've actually been sort of rethinking that because it's difficult to do to drop in, say, an image or something that's fixed width in that design and still account for that fixed element to be cut off or to look odd when the text is resized or if the text is the base font size is different. So that to me the difficulty with an M-based layout is sort of those fixed image problems. So for instance, on Simple Bits, for my blog posts, I've been wanting to do more sort of visual stuff, like drop in an image from Flickr or a photograph or something.
Sure.
But that becomes difficult because it's M-based. And what, if the image is a fixed pixel width, obviously it's hard to just drop that in and design around it so that it looks like it's meant to be there, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And now there are tricks that people have experimented with M-based, setting the image width to M's as well.
Right.
But that, of course, gets tricky when if the image is blown up, it looks, you know, it'll look terrible, or if it's shrunk down, it won't look as nice as it would if it was resized properly. So,
yeah.
So that, to me, that's the biggest drawback to M-based layouts. So you, depending on the site, if the site is not image heavy or if it's, if you're not going to be doing a lot of that sort of image stuff, then M-based layouts can be excellent, and they can provide sort of that flexibility, almost like zooming in and out, just by changing the font size.
Hmm.
So
would you recommend that over, say, a percentage-based layout?
Well, I think that I like they each have their own sort of pros and cons. The percentage-based layout is great as well. So that's like fluid or liquid, right?
Yeah.
And that gives a little more control to the reader, because they can stretch their window out. Now the main problem there is, the max width and min width, or lack of support of max width and min width in Internet Explorer 6 and below. So, the common problem with that, or why people don't use liquid layouts, is if you stretch the window out really, really wide, then the line length becomes a problem, right, with readability.
Mm-hmm.
But that can be solved by setting a max width to certain things. And so in IE6 and below, that's not supported, aside for some JavaScript hack or something. But that does, liquid layouts do offer that extra control for the reader. Some people, it's weird, it's like a religious sort of divide. Some people hate liquid layouts, some people love them or swear by them. And it's interesting how people can get, it can be a heated debate, with designers. I found it's interesting so the iPhone came out over here in the US and I found liquid layouts actually look far better in the iPhone because of that small window width. Mm. And that becomes even more of an advantage, on a smaller screen. Whereas as opposed to a fixed width layout or even an M-based layout, the viewport isn't necessarily computed correctly and you don't take advantage of the full screen. Whereas with a liquid layout, it does. So.
Mm. So when you do like, say, an M-space layout or a full liquid layout, what about mm-hmm. things like margins and padding? Do you kind of do those in the same, you know, settings, or do you do those using pixels, or how do you work with those?
Yeah, that's a good question. So one of the tough parts of a liquid layout, percentage-based, is margins and padding, because Oftentimes you need to add extra elements to add padding around, say if you want a fixed gutter width between columns. Unless you're specifying a percentage, like let's say it's a simple two column layout, the left column is 70% and the right column is 30%, which equals 100%. You can't say the 70% block has a margin right of 10 pixels because now it's 100% plus 10 pixels, which doesn't work.
Yeah.
So you could either, there's a couple choices. You could do a percentage gutter, so it'd be like 65% with a 5% right margin and then 30% on the other side.
Mm-hmm.
Or the other option would be to add another element that's sort of like an inner, like a div that's inside of each, and then add a pixel amount to that without a width at all. So, there's extra markup involved there. One of the things I like about EMS is that it's instead of worrying about percentages, EMS are you can add. It's easier to add gutters and padding with EMS because it's the math works. So you've got a whole width for the layout of say 70 EMS or whatever it is, and then you break that up. Doing the math properly with the width of the columns and then the width of the gutters as well. So percentages are tricky because, you know, you can't go above 100% and it's hard to, you can't take away from a percentage with a pixel amount.
Yeah.
Take away or add with pixel amount. So if you want fixed width gutters and with liquid layout, it often requires extra markup to do that.
What about when it comes to typography? I mean, are you suggesting you always go with M's in situations like that? Or what about, because you've then got to add just more complexity still. You've got keywords that you can kind of throw into the mix there as well.
Right, right. Yeah, I prefer, in my own work, I prefer to use the keyword as a base.
Okay.
So I'll use, oftentimes I'll use small as a base on the whole, on the body, on the whole document. And then use percentages for going up or down from there. So headings would, you know, maybe 120% for a heading or whatever, and then the paragraphs would be 90 or and that kind of thing. I like that because it's to me it's sort of okay. This is a baseline. I know it's not going to be exactly the same in all browsers, but I've had good luck with getting pretty damn close cross-browser sizing that way. The other way to do is with M's, and there's a great article by Richard Rutter actually about sizing text with M's. He wrote a few years ago, and he explains a way of using a percentage as the base to knock it down to M's. Are you familiar with the and then that's sort of, you can relate M units to pixel amounts. So if you're used to sizing text with pixels but want to use M's, he explains a way of sort of knocking down that base so that the math becomes simpler and using, specifying M's but thinking in what that would be in a pixel amount.
Yeah, which is the approach that I normally use. The only thing that does my head in about that is that obviously M's inherit from one another.
Right, exactly.
And that's where it gets really confusing. And
It really does, doesn't it? I mean, especially if you're nesting more than one level deep, right?
Yeah.
Then the math becomes mind-boggling. And that still happens with the keyword percentage model that I use often. The same problem. So when you're nesting percentages, things start to get a little weird, and it becomes a little difficult to do the math. But you know, I found that I'm not often nesting too far. You know, more than maybe two levels or so when I'm sizing things. And if I am, then unfortunately I have to do the math or try a different approach. But that is a tricky part. That is a tricky part of M's or percentages. I mean, in a perfect ideal world, I think the designer could specify pixel, right? And then the browser would resize it properly. from there. But, you know, IE actually 7 and 6 and 5 don't let you resize the text. And I'm kind of baffled why it's still it's still a problem in IE 7.
Mm.
So yeah, that would be ideal, because the designer could say, look, this is what I intend it to be as a base. And this is going to look the same across browsers for the most part, for, you know, most resolutions. And then the user can always override that. I mean, the user should always be able to override that. But unfortunately for baffling reasons, they chose not to, to let someone do that in IE. So that goes back to, I guess, your site statistics. And if IE is a low percentage, which is probably not going to be the case for most sites, you could sort of weigh that and say, well, I'll go with pixels. And I mean, a lot of people do go with pixels now anyway.
Oh.
And just not worry about it. But I tend to, you know, I bump up, so I don't wear glasses, for instance, and I bump the text size up on a lot of sites.
Yeah, I do.
And so if I'm doing that, and I have pretty good eyesight, I imagine a lot of people would as well. So,
okay, so
having that control is important, I think.
Yeah. So one last question then before I let you go and get back to your normal work. You were talking about browsers there. And so Internet Explorer 7 has come along with this kind of zoom page functionality.
Right.
How does that kind of enter in all of this? Does it kind of change the landscape in any way?
I think it definitely helps. And that's what sort of baffles me even more. I've been using the word baffle a lot today, I guess. why they would add the page zoom to IE7 but not allow you to resize font set and pixels.
Hmm.
So I think it helps in a way, but the problem there is that it will, your viewport stays the same. So when you zoom the layout, you know, you'll start to get horizontal scroll bars. And you'll have to sort of navigate the page that way. Whereas just zooming the text, the viewport stays the same and you can read the page a little easier, I find. I mean, it'd be interesting to talk to someone that has low vision and uses, you know, zoom or text bumping up, on a regular basis. But I think that's sort of the downside I see to it is that it can help, but let's say you're looking at a block of text and you use the page zoom feature and your window is small. I mean, let's say you're like on a small screen device or something even, or just your monitor is small or whatever. So zooming in will make it easier to read, but you might have to do some extra navigating of the window, to keep reading that. You know, whereas bumping up the text, you shouldn't have to do that. It should stay within its container, and the window should just, you know, you'd be scrolling down, but you won't be scrolling horizontally.
I mean, that's a particular problem, isn't it, with fluid designs. I've noticed with the zoom function that as soon as you start zooming on a fluid, you know, website, you immediately get horizontal scroll bars, which strikes me as ridiculous.
You know? Right, exactly, right. So, and bumping up the text in a fluid design, should be a lot more, better of an experience. That brings up a good point though with M-based design. Now, when you're bumping up the text with an M-based design, the entire layout, if the layout is set in M's as well, the whole layout will expand, sort of like zoom, but, so that's something to consider as well, where the layout could go beyond the viewport and you could get, horizontal scroll bar as well there.
Yeah.
So if you have an extra wide layout in M's, that can be an issue. Just bumping it up one notch or two notches could cause that sort of scrolling problem.
Yeah.
So
the long and the short of this is there's no right answer, is there? There's no perfect solution here.
Yeah, there really isn't. I mean, like a lot of things, right? In web design, there's not. Yeah, it sort of just depends on a case by case. I mean, people fall into sort of things that work for them you know, like I use the keyword percentage thing and that just seems to work, or, you know, other people like the N-based approach to text sizing. Mm. But neither one is really right. I think you're correct in saying there's no real right answer at this point. It'll be interesting to see how CSS evolves and it affects the way we can lay out pages, and sort of, you know, just the other day I was looking at the CSS 3 grid layout draft. Oh, yeah. Which is pretty, it's pretty amazing. I mean, and maybe we'll be able to use it, in the next 50 years. I don't know.
Well, on that cheery thought of having to grapple with CSS 3, thank you so much for your time, Dan. I appreciate you coming in and kind of explaining the different options that are available.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Bugrad.com.
Okay, so that about wraps it up for today's show. I want to introduce a new little feature into the show because it won't take long to do. But it's called Question of the Week. And I thought each time round I would pose a question on the show, and then we would, you can go along to the show notes and you can post your responses in the comment section. Thought it might be fun. So to kick off it, we just heard Dan Cederholm talking about percentages, M's and pixels. And so my question is, which do you use the most? Are you a percentages person, an M's person or a pixel person? It's just really interesting. I'd like to know, you know, where people choose to go with this, because as was obvious from Dan's comments, there is no wrong or right answer. So post your comments on the show notes. Marcus, do you have a joke to wrap up with?
I do, yes. This is from... Who sent me this one? Hang on a second, I hope to find it.
Because well, it's bound to be Ian. It's always Ian.
No, it's not. No, it's not. I've just got D. A Microsoft support technician goes to a firing range. He shoots 10 bullets at the target 50 meters away. The supervisors check the target and see that there's not even a single hit. They shout to him that he missed completely. The technician tells them to recheck and gets the same answer. The technician then aims the gun at his finger and shoots, blasting it off. He shouts back, "It's working fine here. The problem must be at your end."
See, you should do more techie jokes. They're funny. That is very funny. So funny and yet so true.
Indeed.
Lovely. Yes. So thank you, Marcus. That was a good one. I like that one. Oh, dear. Yes. So there we go. That's the show for this week. I laughed at that too much, didn't I? I've now just embarrassed myself. So that's the show for this week. Thank you very much for listening. Don't forget to check out the show notes at boagworld.com/podcast. I've redesigned that page just slightly because I know it was confusing the hell out of some users. Also, don't forget the 100th episode of Boag World up in London. We would love to see you there. You can sign up at upcoming.yahoo.com/event/224744. We will see you there. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.